From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, changing the world $1 and one prank at a time. First, we learn about James Wolfensohn, the controversial leader who's tried to reform the World Bank. We'll talk to journalist Sebastian Mallaby. His new book is part biography, part institutional history. The World Bank was created 50 years ago to fund development in struggling nations. Then we meet a yes man. Mike Bonanno was part of a team of political pranksters who impersonated World Trade Organization representatives. The yes men went around the world speaking at conferences and fooling everyone. Their documentary is in theaters this week. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a reissue of Visa for Avalon. It's a short political allegory from the 1960s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Tropical Depression Jean is moving through the southeast, causing flash flooding and power outages. In Georgia, officials report 76,000 homes and businesses without electricity. Mike Savage reports from Georgia Public Broadcasting.
When the remnants of Hurricanes Francis and Ivan spun through Georgia earlier this month, those storms spawned deadly tornadoes that damaged homes and businesses and cost the state's agriculture industry millions. No tornadoes or fatalities in Georgia have been reported so far from Jean, but authorities say the storm has caused widespread flooding that closed schools, washed out roads, and forced some evacuations. Kathy Huggins is with the Georgia Emergency Management Agency.
The storm has packed a lot more punch than Francis did. Some of the EMA people are describing it about three times the damage of Francis.
Jean is forecast to move next through the mid-Atlantic states. For NPR News, I'm Mike Savage in Atlanta.
Meanwhile, people in Florida are trying to recover from Jean in its hurricane form. Jean was the state's fourth hurricane in 6 weeks. It was blamed for at least six deaths and as much as $8 billion in insured damages. Millions of people lost electric power. A key prosecution witness in the trial of six Enron and Merrill Lynch executives testified that he and other top Enron executives conspired to falsify the company's books. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports.
Michael Copper was a top aide to former Enron chief financial officer Andrew Fastow, and as such was at the center of the so-called Nigerian barge deal. Prosecutors say the three-way sale was actually a loan fraudulently disguised to look like a sale so that Enron could mark it down as profit, not liability. In his testimony, Michael Copper confirmed that there was a secret agreement between Enron and Merrill Lynch that Enron would buy back the barges they were selling to Merrill Lynch in 6 months at a guaranteed profit. That was exactly what eventually happened. Copper testified that Andrew Fastow giggled while talking to him about the scheme and that they even designated a fall guy, the company treasurer, should the deception be discovered. Wade Goodwin, NPR News.
A federal appeals court has revived a lawsuit filed on behalf of voters in counties that have touchscreen voting machines but don't keep a record of the votes on paper. The suit argues that voters in 15 Florida counties don't have equal protection under the law because without a paper record, it would be impossible to have a manual recount if one became necessary. The suit has been reinstated just 5 weeks before the presidential election. Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials lost 58 points to close at 99.88 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index was down 19 points to close at 18.59. This is NPR News. A Jewish settler shot and killed a Palestinian driver in the West Bank. The suspect claimed the victim tried to run him off the road. Meanwhile, in the West Bank city of Jenin, Israeli troops raided a hospital searching for fugitives. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The settler told police the Palestinian tried to force him off the road, and the settler opened fire. The man reported the incident to police and was arrested. Palestinian hospital officials said the man killed was a taxi driver in his 40s who was making a regular trip and did not try to run the settler off the road. Also today, dozens of Israeli tanks entered the West Bank city of Jenin and took over several buildings. Troops also went into the hospital in Jenin and used loudspeakers to call on fugitives to surrender. They left without making any arrests. In the Gaza Strip, Israeli troops killed two gunmen. Palestinian officials said a civilian was also killed in Khan Yunis at the gate of a local school. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
A lawyer for Yasser Issam Hamdi says Hamdi will be released tomorrow from a military jail after being held for nearly 3 years as an enemy combatant. He said that Hamdi will be flown to Saudi Arabia. Hamdi's a U.S. citizen by virtue of the fact that his Saudi parents lived briefly in Louisiana when he was born. He was turned over to U.S. troops in Afghanistan late in 2001 and accused of fighting alongside the Taliban. Hamdi will be freed under an agreement that requires him to give up his American citizenship and renounce terrorism. He's also agreed not to sue the U.S. government over his captivity. In return, the Justice Department has asked Saudi Arabia not to prosecute him. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Columbia TriStar Home Entertainment, offering Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 on DVD, including 80 minutes of additional features, in stores October 5th.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Anti-globalization protesters have taken to the streets in recent years, condemning international financial institutions like the World Trade Organization as tools of multinational corporations. But some activists have come to feel differently about James Wolfensohn, the charismatic and controversial man who took over as president of the World Bank in 1995. Wolfensohn championed the cause of debt relief for third world nations, condemned the corruption of authoritarian regimes, and opened a dialogue with activist groups. But he's also made enemies inside and outside the bank. Wolfensohn's turbulent ride at the World Bank is the subject of a book by my guest, Sebastian Malaby. Malaby is a columnist for The Washington Post who's covered world development problems for years. He's written most recently about foreign policy issues in the presidential campaign. His book about James Wolfensohn is called The World's Banker. The World Bank lends hundreds of billions of dollars for projects in developing countries. I asked Malaby how it funds its projects.
Well, it does it partly by borrowing the money itself on Wall Street and elsewhere, and then on-lending it to poorer countries who might have trouble borrowing the money directly themselves. And that was the original conception when the World Bank was set up in 1944, when the Second World War was still going on. The concept was that poor countries, or even at that time, sort of war-torn Europe, which needed to be reconstructed after the war, would not have the credit worthiness to borrow on the capital market. So you would need a development bank to get in the middle, to be the borrower on Wall Street and then on lend to the poor countries. But there's a second way it channels money as well, and that is by getting donations from a wide range of richer governments who every 3 years put money into its kitty, and then that subsidizes the World Bank to lend at a very charitable rate, which is effectively three-quarters grant, to the very poor countries who couldn't afford to borrow on the commercial terms.
Now, what was the bank's image in the developing world and among these nonprofit activist organizations who follow it? What was the bank's reputation when Wolfensohn took over in the mid-90s?
Well, that's right. Jim Wolfensohn came to the World Bank in 1995, and just 1 year before, there'd been the 50th anniversary of the World Bank's founding, which was marked in Madrid, Spain, at the annual meetings of the World Bank, which turned into what, although we didn't have the word then, the anti-globalization movement, but effectively that's what hit the World Bank in Madrid that year. There were huge street protests all across Madrid and the old town. People were handing out fake dollar bills saying, you know, World Frankenstein, and, you know, this bill can be redeemed for environmental destruction. So we had, you know, we're familiar now with the Seattle anti-globalization protests, which then spread to the World Bank in 2000 and to other targets like the World Trade Organization and the G7 summit. And that was in 1999-2000. But before that, 5 years earlier, the World Bank had come under the same kind of attack. And that was against the background against which Jim Wolfensohn took over. And his tenure over the last 9 years has been a sort of case study in the question: can a big international organization like the World Bank or any of the other big ones, can it make peace with these activists out there in the street who for one reason or another don't like it?
Give us an example of the kind of project which earned the activists condemnation.
Well, there were a couple of classic cases in the early 80s. One was Polo Noroeste, which was a development project in Amazonia in Brazil, where the World Bank supported a project to sort of build roads into the Amazon and develop it. And although there were various protections built in, there were kind of wildlife reserves and so forth, it was implemented badly and caused enormous amounts of environmental destruction in the Amazon. And that really motivated environmental movements, particularly in the United States, to get active, to go out there, take evidence, take photographs, and come back to Washington with the evidence that the World Bank was harming the people that it was supposed to be helping.
Now, I gather that the previous president, Lewis Preston, had a reputation for ignoring this criticism. I mean, their letters would go unanswered, and he never deigned to have any interaction. Give us a sense of Jim Wolfensohn and sort of the personality and history he brought to the job, and how that might have been different from previous presidents.
Well, that's right. I mean, there was a bit of one of the themes that comes up in my book is the way that the World Bank's shifts mirror shifts in the broader society, in politics, and in thinking. And so just as in 1992, the United States experienced an election in which sort of a patrician, East Coast, slightly buttoned-down figure of George Bush Sr. Lost the election to a kind of charismatic communicator who felt everybody's pain, Bill Clinton. In the same way, the World Bank went through a similar transition in 1995 when Lew Preston, who was very much in the George Bush Sr. mold of a kind of tight-lipped, bad communicator, stumbled over his words, hated the bully pulpit, gave way to this sort of person who wanted to be loved by everybody, Jim Wolfensohn, who was a natural communicator and loved nothing better than, you know, going off to a village in Africa and sitting under a tree in a village with a village chief and discussing life with him. And so this was an entirely new style of leadership, which really shook the World Bank up.
Your book focuses mostly on how effectively he and the World Bank coped with these issues, but he's an interesting character in himself. I mean, he was a concert cellist, an Olympic fencer. Just tell us a little bit about his history.
That's right. He grew up in relative obscurity in Australia and made it via the City of London, where he worked in banking in the 1960s and 70s, to Wall Street, where he not only led the bailout of the Chrysler car company at the end of the 1970s, but then founded his own firm, which went on to make hundreds of millions of dollars. And he himself amassed a fortune of well over $100 million. And then he was also, as you say, an accomplished musician. He took up the cello when he was nearly 40, but he still played on the stage of Carnegie Hall on his 50th birthday with the likes of Yo-Yo Ma, and did it again on his 60th birthday. And his 70th birthday, which I went to last year. And so he has this amazing musical accomplishment. He also represented his country, Australia, in the Olympics in 1956 and continued to be an amazing sportsman thereafter. And he really is one of the most extraordinary networkers. He has a golden Rolodex, which spans the world and ranges from, in Hollywood, you know, people like Harrison Ford, to, on the other side of the world, the Dalai Lama. The network is quite extraordinary.
So he uses that network, in effect, to lobby for this job, lobby President Clinton, and gets it in 1995. He begins with a trip to Africa. Tell us about that first trip that Jim Wolfensohn took to Africa, who he met with, the importance of the kind of the steps he took on that trip.
Well, he set off almost immediately after becoming president of the World Bank, and most people were telling him, no, you shouldn't go out into the field immediately. You need to spend some time at headquarters kind of understanding the organization. But he made it clear that the clients of the World Bank, the poor countries that were borrowing from it, actually mattered to him more than whatever was going on within his headquarters. So he went off, and his first country he went to was Mali, an incredibly poor country in the Sahel. And rather than just meeting with the president and the prime minister, which he did do, he also went off to a village and sat under a tree with the village chief and ate the local nuts that he was given and was saluted by some muskets firing in the sky. And he sort of drank in the whole color of the occasion. He went to, you know, slums and talked to people that he met there. And he clearly just reacted wonderfully to the hospitality of the people he met. He connected with them on a human level. And that did transform the image of the World Bank, which had been seen as a sort of, you know, hard-faced, steely-eyed debt collector for a long time in Africa. And it showed that this was a World Bank that wanted to reach out and to be different and to really help people to understand their problems and not to just dictate that they should, you know, close their budget deficits or control inflation.
One of the things that he learned in Mali was the importance of the country directors for the World Bank to live in and be involved with the countries that they were directing assistance to. And you write a good bit about Uganda and how it was regarded in some respects as a success story of a different kind of development, maybe one in which world bankers listen more closely to and learn from the priorities of that country. Tell us about Uganda and what it tells us about development.
Well, yes, Uganda is a fascinating story. I mean, we've heard of development successes in East Asia. We know that the Asian tigers have made an amazing leap out of poverty in the last generation. But what's perhaps less known is that a country in the heart of Africa, Uganda, cut the poverty rate by 40% in the 1990s. And so if you ask the question, well, how did that happen and what did the World Bank contribute? You know, you can certainly find things that the World Bank did. The World Bank had technical experts who went and gave good advice at certain key points, which enabled the Ugandan government to do its job better. But really the key to putting Uganda on the right track was that there happened to be this extraordinary character who I write about a fair bit in my book, who was a sort of Ugandan technocrat, a sort of enormous guy, well over 6 foot tall, you know, big, strong, booming voice, hard-drinking character, who just told the foreigners who came to give advice to Uganda, you know, if he didn't agree with it, he just told them to get lost. And he drove the agenda. He owned the agenda. He didn't let foreign aid donors tell him what to do.
His name was Emmanuel. Help me with the pronunciation.
Yes, he has a long name. He's called Emmanuel Tumusiimi Mutebile. And his position at first was that he was sort of the chief technocrat, not a government minister, but the sort of top guy, a civil servant underneath him, in one of the two or three different economics ministries. And when President Museveni took power in Uganda in 1986, initially pursued a rather sort of classic statist program of nationalizing things and directing prices from the capital and so on. And this guy, Emmanuel Tumusiimi Mutebile, said to him, "Mr. President, your plan is going to fail completely. So I'm going to ignore what you're telling me. I'm going to go create my own economic plan, which will work. And when you realize that your one is no good, you can come to me and I'll have the plan ready." And because indeed the president's plan did fail totally within about 12 months, he did turn to this technocrat who from then on, you know, his word was always listened to. And so therefore he had the political backing of the president to drive a program of reform of things like liberalizing coffee prices, which allowed poor farmers who grew coffee suddenly to actually get the benefit of their crops rather than having it siphoned off by an inefficient government marketing board, which, you know, pocketed most of the profits. He did reforms like this, and it did cut poverty in Uganda by 40%. And the lesson for the international community, for the donors, and I think for, you know, American foreign aid policy too, is that development really works. Countries really lift themselves out of poverty when the government in place wants to do it. You can't force them to do it from the outside.
My guest is Sebastian Mallaby. His new book is The World's Banker, a story of failed states, financial crises, and the wealth and poverty of nations. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sebastian Mallaby. His book is The World Banker. It profiles the efforts of James Wolfensohn to reform the World Bank. You know, one of the critiques of the World Bank is that it is essentially run by the large developing nations, principally the United States, and the view is that their governments are heavily influenced by multinational corporate interests, and that therefore the World Bank is essentially an agent of international corporations. To what extent are decisions about development projects in the World Bank, do you believe, influenced by specific corporate interests? Say, a company that wants to mine aluminum or expand coffee production, and maybe they get the World Bank to build the railroad or the highway they need to open a new market.
Yes, you're right. That is a common perception. I mean, I think in general, blaming the World Bank for sort of entrenching global poverty by siding with corporations is a bit like, you know, blaming the Red Cross for starting World War One. I mean, the World Bank really is trying to reduce poverty, not entrench it. And the people who go and work there extremely qualified people who could have gone to work for somebody else, Goldman Sachs or McKinsey or some other high-flying job. But they actually want to get into a C-130 transport aircraft and fly into a war zone in Bosnia to help reconstruction there. Or they want to go to Africa and get a well into a village or help out with malnutrition in Southeast Asia. I mean, they, you know, that's why they do this job. But you're right that this question of corporate interest comes up a lot. And I went to Chad, this big landlocked country in Central Africa bordering on Sudan, where you now have this genocide going on. And I looked in detail at one example where the World Bank was arguably in cahoots with big corporate interests.
This was the oil pipeline, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's, you know, Exxon, ExxonMobil was building, developing oil in southern Chad, and it needed to build a big pipeline to go through, which would go through a rainforest where pygmies were still living. And there was obviously great environmental sensitivity as well as social sensitivity about the indigenous people there. And the World Bank was backing this project. And so a lot of groups, like the Environmental Defense Fund, got extremely upset and protested the bank again and accused the bank of all kinds of nefarious conspiracy with ExxonMobil. And it's true that ExxonMobil, I mean, it's a profit-making corporation. It's not, you know, out to save the world. Its incentive is basically just to get the oil out and make some money. And so this is sort of a test case of the point you're raising. But the fact is that the bank's influence on that project was to insist that ExxonMobil do a 19-volume environmental and social impact study to figure out precisely how to make this pipeline in a way that would not disrupt the wildlife as it went through, that would not disrupt the indigenous people as it went through, that would be sensitive to biodiversity and so on. And they oversaw the implementation of this, you know, the building of this pipeline, in a way which was much better than it would have been without the World Bank's involvement.
One of the things that James Wolfensohn did was, in October of 1996, he denounced what he called the cancer of corruption in third world development. You've made the point that one of the things that, that Wolfensohn and others have learned is that the World Bank can help a country when it's determined and committed to help itself. This raised the issue of how you deal with a country steeped in corruption. What was the significance of the president of a World Bank taking this issue on?
Well, he really shattered a taboo with that speech in 1996, because before then, the World Bank's view had been that it couldn't denounce corruption in developing countries because that would be political. And its mandate, its charter, was basically supposed to be an economic and banking institution, not a political one. But what happened is that during the 1980s, when the World Bank essentially focused on getting economic policy right, on allowing prices to dictate where resources flowed, balancing budgets, killing hyperinflation, a decade or more of that did not really lift most of the poor world out of poverty. It didn't work in Africa. You needed to do more than just the economics. You had to think about the politics, because if the political institutions were rotten and corrupt, then nobody could invest, and you wouldn't get growth, and you wouldn't get anywhere. And Wolfensohn saw this. He sort of saw it instinctively, and it went back to early trips he'd made as a young businessman to Nigeria in 1960, where he tried to invest in Nigeria and was immediately confronted with ministers who demanded bribes from him. And he was actually briefly detained by the police in the 60s, who were accused of being a spy in Nigeria because, for one reason or another, he had put his foot wrong. So he understood that if you want development, you need to have countries where people can come and invest and not have their money stolen, and that means dealing with corruption. So he put that on the table, and I know people at the World Bank who were advising him before. You know, you can't say this, and he would say, "I'm the president of the World Bank. I'll say what I want," and he was quite right.
Wolfensohn has been at the bank now for several years. He's in his 70s. What do you think his priorities and lasting impact will be?
I think the lasting impact of Wolfensohn's tenure will be to transform the bank into an institution that is more keen to listen to people in the poor world, not to dictate development policy to them, but rather to ask them what they regard as their priorities. And to support that sort of stance, He has decentralized the bank, so he's moved people out of headquarters in Washington and located them in the field so that they're closer to the client. And he's instituted a policy of reaching out to non-governmental groups as well as people in government and trying to get input from all sides about what the right development policy ought to be. So it's a more open world bank and a less sort of ideological one.
And what are the major projects on the World Bank's agenda now?
I think the major thing on the bank's agenda for the next 5 to 10 years is to figure out a way of playing this middleman position between, on the one hand, the poor countries that want to borrow from the bank, and on the other hand, the rich governments in the north, and also the rich non-governmental groups, the activist groups on the environment and other things like that, which want to use the bank to press their agenda for the developing world, their agenda on the environment, their agenda on the rights of indigenous peoples, which aren't actually always the same as what the majority of people living in the poor world want. And so there's a sort of tension. Is the World Bank going to be the secretariat for the North's ambitions, or is it sort of going to be a service organization for the world's poorest nations?
Well, Sebastian Mallaby, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Writer Sebastian Mallaby. His new book is The World's Banker. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, presenting The Al Franken Show, political commentary, comedy, and interviews, premieres weeknights at 11:30 on Sundance Channel, and from German Information Center, celebrating the Day of German Unity, October 3rd. GIC on the web at germany.unity.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the Yes Men. How to amuse yourself if you're bored, smart, and politically motivated. We meet Mike Bonanno, who joined his friends in a worldwide prank to impersonate members of the World Trade Organization. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Visa for Avalon, a political allegory from the 60s that's just been republished. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest Mike Bonanno is among the anti-globalization activists who believe most international trade policy is aimed at boosting the profits of multinational corporations at the expense of people in the third world. Bonanno and some friends created a website spoofing the World Trade Organization, but a surprising number of people mistook it for the official WTO site and emailed invitations to send them as representatives of the World Trade Organization to conferences. Mike Bonanno and his friend Andy Bickelbaum accepted the invitations and began attending meetings as WTO representatives, presenting bizarre ideas on international development and trade. The group filmed their protest pranks, and the result is Yes Men, a movie in theaters this week and also a companion book. I spoke to Mike Bonanno last week. Mike Bonanno, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Before you got involved with the Yes Men, you were involved in a project called the Barbie Liberation Army?
It's the Barbie Liberation Organization. Uh-huh. In 1993, me and a group of friends got together and started giving surgery to Teen Talk Barbie dolls and Talking G.I. Joes, swapping their voice boxes. So the Barbies said things like, dead men tell no lies. And the G.I. Joes said, I love to shop with you. And we put them back on store shelves just in time for Christmas. As a comment on gender stereotyping in children's toys.
How many did you do?
We did about 300 dolls, and we sent them out to different people all over the country who placed them back on store shelves in a program we called Shop Giving. And, of course, the idea there is that it's the opposite of shoplifting, and with Shop Giving, everybody benefits because you're returning an improved product to the store and they get to sell it twice. And it's a lot less radical than Santa Claus, because Santa Claus, of course, breaks into houses to deliver the presents.
And there you are actually bearing gifts. Now, your partner in the Yes Men, Andy Bickelbaum, was also famous for a stunt involving the computer game SimCity. Explain that.
That's right. He was working for Maxis, the computer game company that makes SimCity, and he was working on a game called SimCopter. And while he was there, sort of bored at work programming, he decided to add a lot of extra content to the game. So among the things that he added were a huge number of kissing boys in swim trunks that would come out at a certain time. It was an Easter egg. So when the egg hatched, everybody was treated to some unusual content in the game, and it was hailed as a great gay activist stunt.
Did both of you managed to avoid lawsuit and prosecution?
Well, there was no lawsuit or prosecution for either of us, although, of course, Andy was fired from Maxis.
What a surprise, yeah. Well, so in your current endeavor, in the Yes Men, you end up getting invited to impersonate the World Trade Organization. How did that happen?
Well, we set up a website at the domain GATT.org, and GATT is the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the predecessor to the World Trade Organization. And some people coming to the website in 1999 didn't realize that it wasn't the actual WTO website, even though the satire was, we thought, fairly clear, and it was put up in support of the 1999 Seattle protests, and had a lot of links there to events happening in the protests. There were still people who didn't recognize that it was a fake website, and they sent us email asking us obscure trade questions, which we tried to answer as honestly and accurately as we could, given our limited knowledge of economics. But we found that after a while, people thought so highly of us and thought that we were the WTO with such, I guess, clarity and conviction that they started inviting us to attend their conferences, fully thinking that we were the World Trade Organization. And we thought about it, and we were sort of faced with an ethical dilemma. You know, what do we do? And we decided the only ethical thing we could possibly do was go and represent the World Trade Organization more honestly than they represent themselves.
So you and Andy went to a conference on tariffs and trade in Salzburg, Austria, right? And your partner, he takes on the name of Dr. was it Andrea Fichelbauer?
Yeah, we got that name from the Vienna phone book. We asked a friend in Vienna to leaf through the phone book and point at a name, and Dr. Andreas Fichelbauer was what we got out of it.
All right, so you guys put on suits, and you're in front of this conference on tariffs and trades. Everybody thinks that you're actually from the World Trade Organization. What was your message at that presentation?
Well, we thought that we would really send up WTO policies, we suggested things like, for example, outlawing the siesta in Spain or the long lunch in Italy because they get in the way of work. And this is in keeping with WTO logic, the idea of the free market solving a lot of problems, and the idea of harmonization, sort of like synchronizing business hours and things so that we're more efficient globally. We also suggested opening a free market in democracy by allowing corporations to sell votes to the highest bidder. And the shocking thing about all this is that we went there fully expecting to either be booed off stage, arrested, or have some kind of weird Austrian, legal situation. But as it turned out, the audience sat there and listened and nodded politely and accepted every horrible thing that the WTO had to say.
Let's hear a clip from the film that involves an occasion where the Yes Men actually got onto a cable television program representing the WTO. Set this up for us.
All right. It was in the summer of 2001. We got an invitation from CNBC Market Wrap Europe to go on live television and debate an anti-globalization activist just before the G8 summit meeting in Genoa. And so Andy ended up going into a studio in Paris, and he was linked up live with a studio in London where they had the international chairman of Accenture, formerly Anderson Consulting, and an activist from the World Development Movement whose name was Barry Coates. And when he ends up being confronted with this crazy World Trade Organization representative, Granwith Hulett Barry, which is the fake name that Andy came up with for the occasion, you find that he's like completely shocked and in disbelief that the WTO representative would speak so honestly about the directions and goals of the WTO.
Okay, so let's hear this clip.
I think Barry, as well as all the other protesters, are simply, in a word, focused too much on reality and on facts and figures. And I think I would have to say that this is a long-term problem that comes down to a problem of education. We have to find a way to convince perhaps not the protesters, but the protesters' children to follow thinkers like Milton Friedman and Darwin and so on, rather than what the protesters have been reared on, Trotsky and Robespierre and Abby Hoffman. And I think that putting the direction of education being put into private hands, concentration of resources in the private sector will naturally lead to this result, and we'll see the protesters' children being reared with an entirely different set of concerns.
So you decided to get more outlandish, and this probably reaches its apogee at the textile conference in Finland, right? What happens there?
Yeah, we decided that we needed something a little more visual, something that would just hit people over the head, where they just couldn't avoid seeing our vision of the what the WTO is. And so we had a golden suit made with a 3-foot-long golden phallus, on the tip of which was a television monitor that we said was the employee visualization appendage. And the whole premise of this suit was that it was a management leisure suit, and that a manager, no matter where they were in the world, could administer electric shocks to workers in sweatshops in the third world. And this took care of what we called the remote management problem. We talked about the history of textiles, because this was a textile conference, and how basically, 150 years ago, we had slavery, and slavery was a very effective way of managing a workforce and keeping costs down. But unfortunately, this thing called the Civil War happened, which got in the way of the natural evolution of slavery into what we have now, which is actually a much more efficient system, much cheaper than slavery. And there's only this one problem, which is that managers can't be right there near the workers. And at the apex of the lecture, I grab Andy's business suit, which is a breakaway business suit. I tear it off, and then he pulls these rip cords, and this 3-foot-long golden phallus inflates, and he explains its purpose. And to our great shock and dismay, nobody found anything wrong with that.
Do you think people tacitly agreed with this, or did they think these people are just kooks? Why ask a question?
I'm sure there were a few people in the audience who thought we were kooks, but there were equal numbers who tacitly agreed, and the reason we know that is that afterward, we went to great lengths to try to raise people's ire afterward. You know, we were invited to the banquet. Andy, I think, who is called Hank Hardy Unruh in that context, Hank Hardy Unruh became like the star of the conference because he had done this theatrical thing, and everybody kind of loved the theatrics of it. And people didn't see a problem with it. There was one woman who we talked to who said that she objected to the shape of the device. And she objected to the shape of the device because it was a phallus. And Andy said, well, what if we change it around a little bit? And he gestured around his chest as if to, you know, make a different kind of employee visualization appendage. And she said, yeah, that would be fine.
Mike Bonanno, he's part of the prankster protest group, the Yes Men. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Mike Bonanno. He is one of the Yes Men, a protest group that went around impersonating representatives of the World Trade Organization. Now, you finally get some reaction when you go to appear before a bunch of students. And as I recall, this presentation was a computer presentation of the idea of recycling human waste into sort of degraded hamburgers to feed the population of the third world. And let's hear a clip of this. Tell us a little bit about what happens here.
Well, it's interesting. Unlike all the audiences of experts that we talked to earlier, these students had a lot less education and a lot less indoctrination into this these ideas of why the free market is necessarily good. And we were relieved, finally, after years of doing this, to speak to the student group and to have them react to the horrible things that the WTO was saying almost immediately. And they started throwing their hamburgers at us. It kind of erupted into bedlam by the end of the lecture.
Okay, so let's hear a clip here where one of the students, I believe, challenges Andy on one of his assumptions. Let's hear this.
I think you guys, like, the WTO is kind of lacking a human element, you know, like, yeah. Have you ever seen starving people?
In pictures, yes.
Okay, but tell me, if you saw somebody starving to death, you would probably think a lot, you know, like, that would kind of hit you in a sensitive, you know, place to say, like, oh, well, you know, maybe markets and money and this and that don't really mean as much, and actually, like, feeding people means a little bit more, you know? Yeah.
Well, it is true that there's a personal side of it that, I have to say, in the WTO, there are questions that we have about this as human beings, but we're not as subject. We have a kind of firmer grasp on theory. We are able, fortunately, to simply direct world trade in a much more theoretical way in collaboration with our colleagues at the largest corporations. So, you know, yes, probably if I went to these countries, I'd think about things a little differently, perhaps, but at the same time, I don't think I would forget all my schooling. I don't think I would forget, you know, all these theories and so on. So perhaps one day I'll do that.
That was Andy Bichlbaum in the film Yes Man. His partner, Mike Bonanno, is my guest today on Fresh Air. Their book, they have a new film, also a companion book called Yes Man. Well, Mike Bonanno, in a nutshell, what is your case against the World Trade Organization?
The World Trade Organization is a bad idea at its core. Its DNA, its core idea, is that it will help businesses do business. And in order to do that, they work on opening markets, on freeing trade. Now, we're looking at what's happened in the last 30 years, and everybody agrees that poverty has in fact increased in the world. That what we have seen in during this period when markets have been opened more than any time previously in history is a greater income gap, more disparity between rich and poor. And all of this leads one to see very clearly that these WTO policies do not work. Now, if we're going to have an organization that's out there that's about an international body, why not have one whose goals are to help people or to help put business in the service of the needs of the poor, the needs of the environment, rather than to help businesses do business? The logic of it is fundamentally absurd. It's a bit like, you know, we're all familiar with the absurdity of the idea of Reagan trickle-down economics, the idea that if you help the rich, if you give tax cuts to the rich, somehow the poor are going to benefit. It didn't work with Reaganomics, and it's not working on a global scale with the policies of the WTO. It's very common for the WTO to say that they're a fundamentally democratic organization, but that is not the case at all. What they're doing, in fact, is undermining democracies all over the world, because what they do is create rules that allow corporations to do what they want no matter what the will of the citizens are. And that's our biggest problem.
But aren't there economists who point out, for example, though, that while there may be examples of abuse and exploitation, that opening of China, for example, to markets and foreign investments has pulled 100 million people out of poverty in that country? I mean, do you see no role for markets and corporations in the developing world?
There's definitely a role for markets, and in many cases, free markets do work, but it does not work as a blanket policy, and it doesn't work as a matter of faith or a matter of course. And unfortunately, that is typically what happens with the WTO. Also, China has been very protectionist over the years. They got to a point where they could be competitive, and they still don't allow companies to go in and buy up, simply purchase all of the rights to certain things in the country. So to say that the free market is operating in China is a fallacy as well, to use that as an example of a success story. They've been very protectionist, and it's worked for them.
You know, in doing this, you do something that most activists never do, which is to actually have face-to-face contact with, well, for lack of a better word, the enemy. I mean, the people who represent the policies and institutions you're condemning. And I'm wondering, when you're setting up these meetings and actually attending these conferences, I'm sure you meet lots of nice, seemingly well-meaning people. And I wonder, does it ever undermine your faith, your commitment to the principles of your protest?
Well, I think we're constantly faced with trying not to make the brunt of the joke the people who are in the audience. That's not what we're trying to do. We have found that the people that we're talking to are typically very intelligent, very interesting, personable. It's just that it's part of a system that's corrupt, a system that's a problem. And sometimes their faith in that system and their unshakable faith is the problem. Generally speaking, when we sit down with them and eat lunch or something, we have a good time. You know, they're like, they could be us. We could be them. And in fact, in the last event that we did when we went to Sydney, Australia, and disbanded the WTO, we announced that the WTO was closing its doors and we were replacing it with something better, the Trade Regulation Organization, that would put the needs of people ahead of the needs of business. We got an overwhelming show of support, even from conservative people who were there. It was an accounting conference, and they said, you know, enough is enough. We agree with you. It's very bold for you to do this, for you to admit that you were wrong and to take a new path. And in the luncheon afterward, they came up with amazing ideas for how to rebuild a trade regulation organization that served the needs of people. And one of the simple ideas to start out with was locating the headquarters in a third world country, so that it was easier for the poorest nations to keep an office there and to have a year-round presence. Because, strangely enough, the poorest nations can't actually afford to keep a year-round presence in Geneva.
Right.
So there were some simple ideas that were great.
I wonder how much, I mean, part of what you do is protest, and part of it is performance. How much are you motivated by, you know, the thrill of being a showman, and how much of it is just affecting social change?
Well, I think we're motivated by both. We enjoy the mischief, you know, we enjoy the play part of it. You know, we sort of joke sometimes. I mean, we're both like pushing middle age, but we like to act like we're, you know, 14. it's, you know, I think that also, you know, we like to pursue these political goals at the same time, and we'd like to see a better world, you know, in our lifetime. And so that's, you know, these things are not mutually exclusive. They can go together.
Mike Bonanno. The movie about his prankster protest group, the Yes Men, will be in theaters this week. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan on a political allegory from the 60s about the loss of civil liberties. This is Fresh Air. Paris Press is a small nonprofit publishing house that reprints the neglected work of women writers, famous and not so famous. Their latest offering is an almost 40-year-old political allegory about the loss of civil liberties called Visa for Avalon. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
In these jittery times when questions of national security dominate the presidential race, Paris Press has decided the moment is right for a rediscovery of a political allegory called Visa for Avalon. The book was first published in 1965, and it was written by an English woman named Annie Winifred Ellerman, who adopted the pen name Breyer. By now, I thought that feminist critics had exhumed even the most minute mummified remains of any literary woman who'd been covered over by the sands of time. But Breyer's corpus and life story are worth bringing to light. In an essay appended to Visa for Avalon, Breyer's biographer, Susan McCabe, tells readers that in 1914 the young Breyer was captivated by the innovations of Imagist poetry, and so she sought out the Imagist poet Hilda Doolittle, or H.D. The two began a lifelong relationship, raising H.D.'s infant daughter in a two-mommy family. Along the way, Breyer also entered into two heterosexual marriages of convenience. With her first husband, she founded a publishing company in Paris that printed the work of out-there writers such as Gertrude Stein, James Joyce, Juna Barnes, Ernest Hemingway, and Marion Moore. She also helped Sylvia Beach to fund the legendary Shakespeare and Company bookshop in Paris. Poet Ezra Pound has been credited with being the intellectual benefactor of the modernist literary movement, but McCabe makes a pithy, convincing case for Breyer's central role. In the late 1930s, Breyer, who was then living in Switzerland, became active in politics. She sheltered and procured visas for over 100 German intellectuals, many of them Jews, fleeing the Nazis. One refugee whom she supported, but ultimately couldn't save, was the philosopher Walter Benjamin, who in despair committed suicide at the Franco-Spanish border when he was prevented from crossing. Throughout the adventures of her life, which also included forays into psychoanalysis and avant-garde filmmaking with Paul Robeson, Breyer kept writing. In addition to Visa for Avalon, she churned out historical novels, memoirs, poetry, and coming-of-age tales. All but the latter have been out of print for nearly 30 years. Visa for Avalon is a short allegory about the devastating cost of political apathy. To be frank, I think its appeal is more that of a literary curiosity than of a call to action. But one thing Breyer's tale has going for it, aesthetically speaking, is a keen sense of suspense. Allegory is the form writers reach for when they want to drum in a message. Consequently, many political allegories feel static. Orwell's Animal Farm and Huxley's Brave New World come to mind, as does Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, my personal nominee for the I Get It Already award in message literature. But Visa for Avalon is a bit of a nail-biter. It's set in a no-name country that looks a lot like England, where a totalitarian movement claiming to be working for the betterment of the common citizenry is about to sweep away individual rights. In her vivid descriptions of the green-jacketed movement sympathizers, Breyer seems indebted to 1950s anti-communist sci-fi movies as well as to her imagist poetic origins. She describes one unthinking victim of the movement's championing of cheap, mass-produced goods as wearing a cap made of white linoleum with an edging of coral beads. Most of the citizens here have resolutely stuck their heads in the sand, but on the eve of a general strike, six thinly drawn characters, including a retired businessman, a secretary, and a simple farm woman, decide to make a frantic try for the last remaining exit visas for Avalon, a country rumored to be off the coast from which no traveler has ever returned. Overcoming roadblocks, mobs, sadistic bureaucrats, and forces of nature, her characters push forward to Avalon, where society perhaps is more enlightened, or not. The indeterminacy of Breyer's ending is one of the subtler aspects of this lively story. As someone who helped refugees escape Hitler, Breyer certainly knew that there's a time when it's wiser to flee into the unfamiliar than to stand and fight a known evil. But Visa for Avalon is certain about one thing. There's never a time to stop thinking, stop questioning. The alternative to informed skepticism is a brain covered with linoleum.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Visa for Avalon, published by Paris Press. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chellug, and Joan Tuohy-Westman. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, underestimating George W. Bush. As we look forward to the presidential debate, writer James Fallows explains how Bush has gotten the better of skilled orators in the past. And he says John Kerry is best when given too little time and forced to think on his feet. Join us for the next Fresh Air.